Honorable Suvandhiran and Mr. Dudangode will take chair.
Honorable Presiding Member, I'm happy to follow the Minister himself as we discuss the votes on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Minister is an experienced parliamentarian, an able person, and I'm glad to discuss a few matters with regard to Sri Lanka's foreign policy while he is present, together with also a very able and dynamic young parliamentarian, the Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. It was rather comical to witness the spectacle this morning as we started the debate. The bickering between the government benches and the main opposition, each trying to absolve themselves from responsibilities they had undertaken in the international arena. Honorable Lakshman Kiriyalla blaming President Mahinda Rajapaksa for agreeing with the Secretary General of the UN on the 26th of May 2009 in Kandy, undertaking to inquire into the allegations of human rights violations. And for his part, the Honorable Minister blaming the main opposition when they were in office for co-sponsoring resolution HRC 30/1 before the UN Human Rights Commission. These acts are not acts of certain governments that are in office at a particular point in time. These undertakings are given on behalf of the state. And in the international system, these obligations are taken very seriously. The minister read out the letter sent in February this year, claiming to withdraw from the co-sponsorship of Resolution HRC 31. All of us know that you can't withdraw from an act that is already done. The minister was heard to say in this house that that co-sponsorship happened without the knowledge of anyone, not even the president at that time. I want to ask a question. If that be so, how did Sri Lanka co-sponsor Resolution 34-1 and 41 several months thereafter, both of which were merely rollover resolutions of 30/1? 30/1 was done on the 1st of October 2015. 34-1 was in March 2017, and 41 was in March 2019. Three times over, same contents. And how does the responsible minister stand up here and say, nobody knew about the contents? These undertakings are on behalf of Sri Lanka, of the state. There are serious repercussions if you resign from international commitments. I want to pose another question. On the 29th of July 1987, Sri Lanka entered into an international bilateral agreement with India, commonly known as the Indo-Lanka Accord. Various speakers in this house at various times say various things about this agreement. Would you have, Mr. Foreign Minister, would you have the courage to write a letter to India like you did to the UN Human Rights Council and withdraw from the Indo-Lanka Accord? If you don't, and you haven't done that, over several decades of your party in office, you must honor it. You must honor it. No point saying this was thrust down our throat. If it was thrust down your throat, withdraw. Write a letter to India like you did to UN Human Rights Council. Are you brave enough to do that? If you don't, I'll read out the fundamental principles of the Indo-Lanka Accord, which is still binding on Sri Lanka. It's an international bilateral agreement. First, Sri Lanka is a multi-ethnic and a multilingual society. Two, each ethnic group has a distinct cultural and linguistic identity which has to be carefully nurtured. And three, the northern and the eastern provinces have been areas of historical habitation of Sri Lankan Tamil-speaking peoples. Basic principles laid down at the forefront of Indo-Lanka Accord. You can't recile from that, nor can you even recile from undertakings given to the UN Human Rights Council, not once but three times. But more importantly, what President Rajapaksa did before President Rajapaksa did that in May 2009, on the 2nd of March 2009, Honorable Mahinda Samarasinghe, on behalf of Sri Lanka, said this at the UN Human Rights Council. He says, our national discourse has been dominated for decades by an ethnic issue which requires a political solution as a means to resolve the problem. He didn't say military solution. He said it requires a political solution. On a recommendation of the All-Party Representative Committee, we are able to properly implement the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which was passed in 1987. Words of your government's minister at that time. And following that, on the 26th of May, this is what President Mahinda Rajapaksa said in a joint communique with the UN Secretary General. President Rajapaksa expressed his firm resolve to proceed with the implementation of the 13th Amendment, as well as to begin a broader dialogue with all parties, including the Tamil parties, in the new circumstances, to further enhance this process and to bring about lasting peace and development in Sri Lanka. Now, why did he do that? Will you write a letter to the UN Secretary General withdrawing from this commitment that your president did on the 26th of May 2009? He said this, not only the implementation of the 13th Amendment, 11 years have passed and it has not been implemented. Your solemn promise, your leader's solemn promise to the Secretary General of the UN, no less. I'm saying this because there are repercussions if you don't deliver on your promises to the international community. You pride yourself that we are a part of the civilized community of nations. We will not be part of a civilized community of nations if we willy-nilly ignore and violate commitments that we make to the international community. And the very next day, on the 27th of March, May 2009, a day after President Mahinda Rajapaksa agreed, with this. This I'm only referring to his guarantee of implementation of the 13th Amendment and going beyond that. But there are other agreements in that with regard to violation of human rights and that there will be a domestic mechanism. In your letter in February this year, too, you say there will be a domestic mechanism. Where is it? Several months have passed. Where is that? Where is that plan? Where is that plan? For 11 years you fooled the world. Now for 11 months or so you have fooled the world. Or you think that you can fool all the people all the time. That's what you think. Because the very next day, at the UN Human Rights Council, a resolution was adopted, which said, welcoming also, I quote, welcoming also the recent assurance given by President of Sri Lanka. The previous day he gave that assurance. Welcoming also the recent assurance given by the President of Sri Lanka that he does not regard a military solution as a final solution, as well as his commitment to a political solution with the implementation of the 13th Amendment to bring about lasting peace and reconciliation in Sri Lanka. So 13th Amendment implementation was a first step that was promised over and over and over again, not just to the UN Human Rights Council, but to India. And I'm going to read the three joint communiques that were issued, once with Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh, where President Mahinda Rajapaksa's commitment was recorded. The Prime Minister emphasized that a meaningful devolution package, this was in June 2010, 10 years have passed, building upon the 13th Amendment, that's what Honorable Mahinda Rajapaksa said, would create the necessary conditions for a lasting political settlement. So he's a building up. There comes Honorable Mahinda Samarasinghe, who gave the assurance to the UN on the 2nd of March 2009. The President of Sri Lanka reiterated his determination to evolve a political settlement acceptable to all communities that would act as a catalyst to create necessary conditions in which all the people of Sri Lanka could lead their lives in an atmosphere of peace, justice and dignity, consistent with democracy, pluralism, equal opportunity and respect for human rights. Towards this end, the President expressed his resolve to continue to implement in particular the relevant provisions of the Constitution designed to strengthen national amity and reconciliation through empowerment. In this context, he shared his ideas on conducting a broader dialogue with all parties involved. The Prime Minister of India expressed India's constructive support for efforts that build peace and reconciliation among all communities in Sri Lanka. Now this was followed when Professor, then External Affairs Minister Professor G.L. Pierce visited New Delhi in May 2011, and a joint press statement, I'm glad Professor Pierce is in the house when I quote him, that External Affairs Minister of Sri Lanka affirmed his government's commitment to ensuring expeditions and concrete progress in the ongoing dialogue between the government of Sri Lanka and representatives of Tamil parties. A devolution package building upon the 13th Amendment, words of assurance given by Professor Pierce to India, building upon the 13th Amendment would contribute towards creating the necessary conditions for such reconciliation. Again reiterated in January 2012, when External Affairs Minister S.M. Krishna visited Sri Lanka, and with Professor Pierce by his side, this is what he said. The government of Sri Lanka has on many occasions conveyed to us its commitment to move towards a political settlement based on full implementation of the 13th Amendment of Sri Lankan Constitution and building on it so as to achieve meaningful devolution of powers. We look forward to an expeditious and constructive approach to the dialogue process. A decade has passed. You haven't done a thing. Some effort was taken in the last government. We participated in good faith. Members who are now in the government also participated. The Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs was a member of the steering committee. Honorable Susil Premajayanth even headed an ad hoc committee.
Honourable Member, you have three more minutes.
Thank you. With regard to relations between the Parliament and provincial councils, and gave a good report. Honourable Bandula Gunawadana chaired another committee. Honourable Mahinda Samarasinghe chaired another committee on human rights or fundamental rights, and gave a brilliant report. Honourable Dr. Vijayadasa Rajapaksa, who hides behind his lamp all the time here in this house in these sessions, was also a member of the steering committee and drafted the proposals with regard to land powers. So there was an effort, but that you have abandoned now. And there talk of repealing. Sorry? Yes, State Minister. Sorry?
Honorable Tarak Walsuri.
Thank you. So I thank you for that assurance that you will abide by all the assurances given to the world. Before I conclude, I need to touch on one or two other matters. I'm thankful for the number that the minister gave, that of Sri Lankans who have been repatriated. But there is a serious issue with regard to people in the Middle East, our labor force who contribute so much to our economy, not being given priority in the repatriation process. I hope the foreign minister will look into that and give them priority. Secondly, this is the month of November, in which I said some time ago also, all those who died in wars are remembered. That is why we sell poppy. It's world over. This is the period in which that happens. And in Sri Lanka, particularly in the Tamil areas, for the last 3 decades, it has become a custom to remember the dead who fought the war. They may have fought the state, but nevertheless, they are dead, and their families and others have a right to remember them, as they are accustomed to do. The government has taken great exception to this now, suddenly this year, and is flying members of the Attorney General's Department by special helicopters to Jaffna, to Mullathivu, all over the place. Amid COVID restrictions, when the Attorney General's Department is in an isolated zone, they are flying around all over without being quarantined to oppose and to obtain orders from magistrates preventing mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers remembering the dead.
Honourable Member, your time is up. Please wind up.
Most unfortunate. Yeah, I'm winding up. Most unfortunate. This. Okay, From Adaikalnathan's time, I'll take 5 more minutes. Most unfortunate, most undignified act by the state. Honoring the dead, remembering the dead, is, even in our culture, a solemn affair. To be chasing after people. The other day, I stood with a mother, 83 years old. She has only a shack for a house. Her son died in 1985. And as she lit her lamp, I participated in that event. A solemn occasion. Why are you so worried? Why are you so scared of the dead? Is it because you put them to death in the most brutal manner, violating all the international norms? The other thing is, sovereignty is for all the people. Sovereignty is not to be enjoyed by the majority only. And that must be kept in mind. If the majority only enjoys sovereignty, then you are leaving the other peoples out. You are forcing them to claim their own sovereignty. And that would be your own act. The foreign minister, when he started, he said he wants to give a lesson to Honorable Lakshman Kiriyalla about the fact that India is a union because they have a princely states and they had to all be brought together. I want to ask him about the history of this island. When Europeans conquered this island, was there one state here? Was there one kingdom in this island? No, there wasn't one kingdom in this island. There were three kingdoms in this island. And they all fell to Western powers at different times. It was only in 1833, consequent to Colebrooke Cameron Commission report, that for administrative convenience, it was made one country. So you must remember when you try to take lessons on how India became a union or how the United States of America became states coming together, remember the history of this country as well. This country consists of different peoples who each have their own rights in international law. Violation of international law is not a domestic matter. You can't hide behind the cloak of sovereignty, state sovereignty. There is nothing called state sovereignty today. Sovereignty is to be enjoyed by the people. You can't hide behind the concept of a state sovereignty and violate international law and claim that it's a domestic matter. No, it is not. You know that very well. So, fashioning the country's foreign policy, you have now gone on reverse gear. You put the country at peril, and on this particular occasion, when we debate the votes of the foreign ministry, I think it is our duty to bring it to your notice that you need to turn around. And promoting accountability and reconciliation is not a matter that violates the sovereignty of any country. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Professor G.L. Pierce, you have 13 minutes.
Mr. Presiding Member, it is a pleasure to follow the contribution by the Honorable M.A. Sumandiran. As we debate the foreign policy of our country in this August Assembly, circumstances in the world at large are certainly not propitious. COVID-19 has proved to be a dire calamity. There are many lessons to be learned from this situation. One of the most important lessons is that no nation, no group of countries, no culture has a monopoly of wisdom. Nobody can claim to know all the right answers. The contemporary experience of the world demonstrates convincingly that there is no room whatsoever for arrogance, bigotry, and self-righteousness. Today, more than at any other time in our history, if we survive this crisis at all, it can only happen on the basis of humility, the spontaneous sharing of experiences, and a readiness to work hand in hand in a spirit of comradeship and solidarity. The cornerstones of the foreign policy of our country are crystal clear. They were set out with exemplary clarity by His Excellency the President Gotabaya Rajapaksa at his inauguration in the hallowed precincts of the Ruang Valley Sire Temple in Anuradhapura. We seek friendship with all nations. We go out of our way to refrain from interfering in the domestic affairs of other nations. At the same time, reciprocally, we entertain the expectation that others will respect, without question, the right of the Parliament and the people of Sri Lanka to determine our own destiny. This is the rationale underpinning the statement made by the Foreign Minister of Sri Lanka, the Honorable Dinesh Gunawardena, at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, barely 3 months after the assumption of office by His Excellency Gotabaya Rajapaksa. The government which the Honorable Dinesh Gunawardena represents unequivocally rejected the resolutions of the Human Rights Council, 30/1, 34/1, and 40/1, respectively, of 2015, 2017, and 2019. These resolutions were not only supported, but indeed co-sponsored by the Ihapalana government of that time. This is scarcely believable when one considers the content and the impact of these resolutions. Indisputably, those resolutions dealt with matters which were within the purview of national institutions in Sri Lanka. They required the rearrangement of Sri Lanka's constitutional provisions, the restructuring of our armed forces and the police, the repeal of major legislation such as the Prevention of Terrorism Act. These resolutions also empowered foreign and Commonwealth judges to adjudicate on grave allegations relating to war crimes which were leveled against the armed forces of Sri Lanka. That is the effect of Operative Para 6 of the resolution of 2015. This was in blatant violation of the supreme law of this country, the Constitution. This abdication of self-respect was further compounded by the acceptance by that government of the obligation to report from time to time to the Human Rights Council and to abide by the judgment of that council in respect of the adequacy of the progress that had been made in respect of the implementation of these resolutions. Mr. Presiding Member, the entire edifice of the UN system is based upon one sacred principle, and that is a principle relating to the sovereign equality of nations. That principle is illustrated amply by the seminal instruments of the United Nations system, such as the Charter, the Declaration of Human Rights, and the jurisprudence of the International Court of Justice, and its predecessor, the Permanent Court of International Justice. All countries that are members of the international community, be they large or small, affluent or not so affluent, are equal in the eyes of the United Nations system, Mr. Presiding Member. Equal in intrinsic worth, equal in inherent value. There can be no discrimination whatsoever. This is why there can be no scope whatsoever for talking down, for hectoring, and for patronizing attitudes. This is not to be misunderstood. Counsel from friends, the sharing of experiences, and suggestions that are made in a spirit of goodwill and friendship are always welcome. They are healthy. But what is absolutely ruled out are judgmental postures in respect of the internal decision-making processes of countries dealing with matters which are within their purview. Now, I have dealt, Mr. Presiding Member, with the concept of equality, that equality is basic to the entire United Nations system. But there's another principle that is equally important, and that is the principle of fairness. This is an instinct that is embedded in human nature, and it represents a component of all systems of law and justice, and indeed of all civilizations since time immemorial. One must look at both sides of an issue. Evidence has to be weighed in the balance, and conclusions must be arrived at objectively without bias or prejudgment. From that standpoint, very sadly, the people of Sri Lanka have good reason to entertain grave misgivings. Evidence of the highest value has been deliberately disregarded if that evidence is favorable to the armed forces of Sri Lanka. A clear example of that consists of military dispatches by trusted members of foreign countries reporting confidentially to their own capitals. These have been totally ignored. And these dispatches were ferreted out with the greatest difficulty, as the Honorable Dinesh Gunawardena pointed out, by personages of the eminence of Lord Michael Naseby, both within the House of Lords and outside. There were also very critical findings by Queen's Counsel of the eminence of Sir Desmond de Silva, Sir Geoffrey Nice, Rodney Dixon. These findings completely exonerated the armed forces of Sri Lanka from any form of culpability or guilt with regard to war crimes under principles of international humanitarian law, international human rights law. So this document, this body of evidence was there, it was never taken into account, it was deliberately ignored. This was done in the lofty name of human rights, but it constituted a cynical violation of natural justice and the rules of fairness, both in its substantive and its procedural dimensions. I don't wish to take much time, Mr. Presiding Member. Sri Lanka, we want to insist, is a country with a proud history and a cherished heritage. Reconciliation, ethnic harmony, transitional justice, these are not concepts which are by any means alien to us. We have been nurtured throughout the ages by a rich and vibrant cultural tradition in each of these areas. But I want to stress that the mechanisms we evolve, if they are to aspire to any measure of success, must necessarily derive from the aspirations of our people. This is because of the importance of context with regard to these matters. The government of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa, fortified by an unrivaled mandate obtained from the people of this country at both the presidential and the parliamentary elections, has an unflinching resolve to address these issues in earnest. The government has both the moral and the legal right to the space to do so. And we ask for empathy and understanding as we move forward in partnership with the international community to assure to our people a stable and prosperous future. I thank you, Mr. Presiding Member.
Thank you. Honorable Mrs. Harini Amarasuri, you have 13 minutes.
Thank you for this time, Honorable Presiding Member. I must apologize to the House if I am breaking the rhythm of what has been a fascinating debate so far by shifting your attention from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to mass media. Mass media plays a critical role in the social and political lives of people. The quality of media in each society, the degree of independence and freedom are often taken as indicators of the quality of democracy in these societies. We generally regard media as having two functions, one as a watchdog, providing politically relevant information to citizens that supporting their ability to make informed political decisions, and secondly, serving as a public forum representing the diversity of views in that society. Traditionally, media consisted of print, radio, and television. But today, we see the internet and digital media platforms becoming far more influential, both as a watchdog and as a public forum, more than in other types of media. The emergence of digital media, arguably, has meant that the institution of media has become far more democratic. Today, every citizen has the potential to be a journalist. All of us are able to create news, share news, comment on news, and to engage in discussions which can reach a large audience very quickly. Public figures, those in power, are under much more scrutiny than before. This is great from one perspective. It has enabled a duplicity of voices and a multiplicity of voices and perspectives to emerge, which is always a good thing. And it has created a much larger critical space regarding public accountability. At the same time, we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be truthful, objective, independent and ethical in this context? More importantly, how do we assess what is truthful, objective and ethical in this context? What is the validity of these multiplicity of voices, opinions and perspectives that are offered to us today? These are issues that societies around the world are grappling with, and the tension between freedom of expression, right to information, and protecting citizens from misinformation. This has become all the more challenging when media organizations, including social media platforms, operate on the principle of profit is no secret. In recent times, globally as well as in Sri Lanka, we have had many examples of the extent to which digital platforms, particularly social media, can be manipulated to serve particular interests, mobilize hate and violence very quickly. Yet media regulation is a highly controversial issue, since it is tied up so closely with the freedom of expression and right to information. Government efforts at regulation are viewed with particular suspicion. Sri Lankan governments usually do not have a good reputation for dealing with media. In fact, Sri Lanka at various points during the last several decades was considered extremely dangerous for those working in this field. The list of media personnel who have disappeared, been killed, threatened, intimidated and forced to leave the country is far too long and serves as a severe indictment on successive governments. Most of these cases remain unresolved and often forgotten. Officers investigating well-known cases such as that of Lasantha Wickramathunga, Pragit Eknailiyagoda are now themselves being hunted. As a result, these cases are stuck with no progress and no resolution in sight. Such a situation hardly inspires confidence in the government's intentions with regard to protecting a free and independent media. Unfortunately, governments have regarded the media either as their enemy or as propaganda machines, which can be manipulated at their will. We also have to deal with a situation where our traditional media, whether state or privately owned, are known to promote particular political agendas. Most media institutions in Sri Lanka are owned by individuals or families closely linked to mainstream political parties. Governments in power usually consider state-owned media as their propaganda machine, since private media is also closely aligned with mainstream political parties. Governments also then control private media. As a result, Sri Lanka has very few truly independent traditional media organizations, either in print, radio or television. It is in this context that digital media platforms, however controversial, and despite all the concerns that I have mentioned previously, have become an important space for hosting alternative and critical perspectives. Honorable Presiding Member, it is in this context that we need to seriously consider this proposal reported in the Parliament website that the Honourable Minister for Mass Media has stated at the Consultative Committee meeting on mass media held on the 21st of November that a website regulatory mechanism will be implemented within the next 2 weeks. Can such an important... May I finish, if you don't mind? Then we can respond. Can such an important and crucial regulatory mechanism be implemented within or established within 2 weeks? Members present at that committee, some of whom are in the chamber today, had also made references to legislation recently passed in Singapore as an example of what could be followed in Sri Lanka. Now, it has become quite common, as you know, for Singapore to be held up as the model for Sri Lanka for all things that we need to do. When we do so, when we hold Singapore up as this model, we tend to overlook the fact that it's an extremely tightly controlled society where the idea of dissent and protest, so essential for democracy, is not tolerated. Just recently, it was reported that a Singaporean man, was arrested for unlawful assembly, for holding a placard with a smiley face in front of a police station. Internet freedom is limited in Singapore, and government has high powers of censorship, which it uses to stifle criticism and opposition views. Is this what we aspire to? I don't think so. Sri Lankan citizens are highly politically literate, and any regulatory mechanism that attempts to stifle the freedom to debate and engage with political ideas would be highly detrimental to our democratic space. While there is legitimate concern of how digital media platforms can distort information, propagate hate speech, etc., far more dangerously than traditional media, this move by the government to introduce regulatory mechanisms is of deep concern, because the actions of this government and governments historically in Sri Lanka suggest that its intentions are not to regulate, but rather to stifle dissent and the views of its critics, while giving a free license to their own supporters to attack their political opponents. For example, many of us have been victims of fake posts on social media platforms. Several of us have filed complaints with the CID regarding this, but none have been investigated satisfactorily. Yet, social media commentators like Ramzi Rasik, who was arrested under the ICCPR and Computer Crimes Act, currently on bail, was arrested after he made a complaint of threats that he received on something he had said on social media. During the first cycle of COVID-19, the police warned media outlets against spreading false or malicious information. This included any criticism of government officials. The basis for this kind of stand is legal basis is yet to be known. Darisha Bastians, former editor of the Sunday Observer, faced much harassment over her alleged connection with the abduction of a member of the Swiss embassy. Very recently, an individual was questioned by the CID for sharing an image on Facebook. Journalists reporting on environmental issues have been threatened, and two journalists were assaulted recently in Mulatiu when reporting on a deforestation problem. Media persons have reported that they asked for unnecessary information when the government issues press passes, and that the government has hinted at imposing restrictions when issuing passes. The insinuation here is that being critical of government policy is an act of betrayal. Overall, journalists have reported an increase in self-censorship because of an environment of fear and intimidation. What is particularly of concern here is that the government is adopting double standards when it comes to media regulation, especially investigation of fake news. Criticism of the government is interpreted as fake news, distortion, and malicious, and prompt action is taken, whereas pro-government media are allowed to say or do whatever it wants about the opposition or critics of the government. Thus, there are legitimate fears when the government says it wants to regulate media, since our experience is that under the guise of regulation, what the government is seeking to do is actually suppress dissent and critique. We cannot ignore the fact that there are many occupying extremely powerful positions in this government who are allegedly associated with the disappearance, intimidation, and even deaths of media persons. At no point has this government shown that it is tolerant of criticism and dissent. Rather, the reaction to criticism has been highly defensive and aggressive. The ethos is one of intolerance, and that is hardly conducive to freedom of expression. The intention of the government, therefore, to establish within 2 weeks a regulatory mechanism for websites is truly worrying. If such a move is envisaged, then at the very least, the government needs to engage in a consultative process to obtain the views of all concerned. Also, if the intention of the government is to promote responsible and ethical media practice, then it needs to start with enabling the independence of media organizations. Even if it can't do so for privately owned media organizations, government can always claim that that is run on the principles of the market, it can certainly start by guaranteeing independent standards in the state-owned media. There is also a state ministry under this Ministry of Mass Media for professional development of journalists. Of course, it is also on the Ministry of Postal Services, so it's not very clear how much is allocated for in the budget for professional development of journalists or what plans there are to strengthen professionalism among journalists. Yet, clearly, this is an extremely important area, and there is much the government can do if it is serious about improving the quality of journalism. There are many young people interested in journalism and media, but they do not see this as a career path due to various reasons, not the least being lack of career prospects and security in this sector. Combine that with the culture of fear and intimidation that Sri Lankan journalists have to contend with, how many would consider this as a viable career option? In conclusion, in an increasingly complex media space, there is no doubt that a robust dialogue on media ethics and professionalism is urgently required. But what we are seeing today is not a genuine desire to improve the quality of media or to deal with the very real issues emerging as a result of the transformation of media platforms and the media space. Rather, what we are seeing are attempts to curtail the freedom of expression, protection of pro-government media organizations and persons, and an atmosphere of intimidation and harassment of critical voices. This is surprising in a government that keeps talking about its popular mandate, because what it is actually reflecting is a deep sense of insecurity about its popularity and legitimacy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Garu Kehliya Rabukkal Amtuma.
I think it's very unfortunate that your party leader has not included you in the consultative committee of the mass media by looking at listening to your contribution. In fact, all these moves are discussed at the consultative committee. It is not a move by me particularly. And this was discussed at length. It took 1.5 hours, and I think one of the longest sessions that we had. And in that, it was one of your members, one of the members of the committee, suggested that there should be some kind of monitoring of the social media. Whereas we, when I was the minister then, we had numerous discussions as to how you deal with this situation. And then, firstly, as a primary move, we discussed that social media institutions to be registered under the Ministry of Mass Media. And that is exactly what we discussed. It has been misinformed completely that we are going to have a monitoring body with regard to the Facebook and so on. But it was just a registration which all the people agreed at that time. They said to safeguard their dignity. And that should be the case. And we had only a debate over the price. We had 100,000 for a registration and 25,000 for annual fee, which they requested to make 25,000 a registration fee and 5,000 annual fee, which we readily agreed then in 2014. Unfortunately, during the 5 years, nothing happened. And therefore, we took it up the first consultative meeting, we took up this, and there were so many things that flow out of the flow of the consulted the committee. So that is exactly so. I'm sure you are completely misled something, question
you.
Of misinformation. And your members also, some of members,
I think,
participated in the consultative committee. And I'm extremely sorry to say that your leader has not included such an eloquent and informed lady who has been a member of this house into our constitutional consultative committee.
Thank you. Parliament Diva Ahare Sandha Pasur Ekadakwa Tavakalika Vattituvame.